business was strong-armed out of town by a bunch of mobsters whom he knew better than to identify. By cross-checking, Marshall found that in every case, the deposed city councilman or councilwoman was replaced by a new person connected in some way with either the Universal Consciousness Society or Omni Corporation, or both. And in every case, the deposed person thought that he or she was the only one who had left. Now, out of fear, out of self-interest, out of that typical reluctance to get involved, all of them remained far away, out of touch, out of the picture, saying nothing. Some were cooperative in answering Marshall's questions, and some felt very threatened. All in all, though, Marshall got what he was after. As for those who used to own businesses now run by this mysterious incognito corporation, very few of them had planned on selling out, moving out, or giving up their peaceful lives in Ashton or their successful businesses. But the reasons for leaving were consistently along the same lines. Tax bunglings, harassments, boycotts, personal problems, marriage dissolutions, perhaps a disease or a nervous breakdown here and there, with an occasional macabre tale of strange, maybe supernatural occurrences. Former Ashton District Judge Anthony C. Jefferson's story was ominously typical.
Word started circulating around the courthouse and the legal community that I was on the take, receiving bribes for fixing sentences, letting people off. Some false witnesses even confronted me and made accusations. But it never happened. I swear it with all that I have in me.
Then can you tell me the truth about why you left Ashton?
Marshall asked, almost knowing what kind of answer to expect.
Personal reasons as well as professional. Some of these reasons remain with me even now and are still viable enough to restrict what I can share with you. I can say, however, that my wife and I were needing a change. We were both feeling the pressure, she more than I. My health was failing. We, at length, thought it best to get out of Ashton altogether. May I ask, sir, if there were any unfavorable outside influences that brought about your decision to step down from the bench?
He thought for a moment, and then, with some bitterness in his voice, said,
I cannot tell you who they were. I have my reasons. But I can say, yes, some very highly unfavorable influences.
Marshall's last question was, and you really can't tell me anything about who they might be?
Jefferson gave a sardonic chuckle and said,
just keep going the way you are, and you will find out soon enough yourself.
Jefferson's words were beginning to haunt both Marshall and Bernice. They had heard many similar warnings as they went along, and both of them were growing more aware of something out there around them, building, coming closer, growing more and more malevolent. Bernice tried to shrug it off. Marshall found himself resorting more and more to quickly blurted prayers. But the feeling was still there, that disturbing sense that you are nothing but a sandcastle on the beach, and a 20-foot wave is about to crash down on you. On top of all this, Marshall had to wonder how Kate was holding up through all of this, and how he would ever patch things up between them when this was finally over. She was talking about being a widow again, a newspaper widow, and had even made some very embarrassing suggestions about Bernice. Man, this thing just had to get over with. Much more of it, and he wouldn't have much of a marriage to come home to. And then, of course, there was Sandy, whom Marshall hadn't seen in weeks. But when this was all over, when it was really finally over, things would be different. For now, the investigation he and Bernice were doing was incredibly urgent, a top priority, something that grew more ominous with every new stone they turned. Chapter 23. When things around the office were in their usual quiet post-Tuesday state, Marshall had Carmen search out a good-sized cardboard box and some file folders, and he began to organize the piles of papers, records, documents, scattered notes, and other information he and Bernice had compiled in their investigation into an orderly file. As he went through it all, he also compiled a list of questions on a legal pad on his desk, questions he intended to use in his interview with the first of the real principals in this plot, Alf Rommel. That afternoon, after Carmen had left for a dentist appointment, Marshall made a call to Alf Brummel's office.
"Police department," said Sarah's voice.
"Hi, Sarah, this is Marshall Hogan. Can I have a word with Alf?"
"He's out of the office right now."
Sarah let out a long sigh and then added in a very strange, very quiet tone of voice,
"Marshall, Alf Brummel does not want to talk to you."
Marshall had to think for a moment before he said,
"Sarah, are you caught in the middle?"
Sarah sounded miffed.
"Maybe I am. I don't know, but Alf told me in no uncertain terms that I was not to put through any calls from you, and that I was to let him know whatever your intentions were."
"Huh. Look, I don't know where friendships end and professional ethics begin, but I sure wish I knew what was going on around here." "What is going on around there?"
"What'll you trade me for it?"
Marshall knew he was taking a chance.
"I think I can find something of equal value if I look hard enough."
Sarah hesitated for just a moment.
"From all appearances, you've become his worst enemy. Every once in a while I hear your name coming through that office door of his, and he never says it nicely."
"Who's he talking to when he says it?"
"Uh-uh. It's your turn."
"All right. Well, we talk about him, too. We talk about him a lot, and if everything we've uncovered checks out, yeah, I just might be his worst enemy. Now, who's he talking to?"
"Some of them I've seen before. Some of them I haven't. He's put several calls through to Julene Langstrat, his whatever she is."
"Anyone else?"
"Judge Baker was one, and several members of the city council."
"Malone?"
"Yes."
"Everett?"
"Yes."
Preston?"
"No."
"Goldtree?"
"Yes, plus some other VIPs from out of town, and then Spencer Nelson from the Windsor Police Department, the same department that supplied our extra manpower for the festival. I mean, he's been talking to a lot of people, far more than usual. Something's up. What is it?"
Marshall had to be careful.
"It might involve me in the Clarion. It might not."
"I don't know if I'll accept that or not."
"I don't know if I can trust you or not. Whose side are you on?"
"That depends on who the bad guy is. I know Alf is shady. Are you?"
Marshall had to smile at her spunk.
"I'll have to let you be the judge of that. I do try to run an honest paper, and we have been carrying on a very intensive investigation of not only your boss, but just about every other bigwig in this town."
"He knows it. They all do."
"Well, I've talked to just about all of them. Alf was next on my list."
"I think he knew that, too. He told me just this morning that he did not want to talk to you. But he's sure talking up a storm with everybody else. And he just left here with a pile of papers under his arm, heading for another hush-hush meeting with someone."
"Any idea what they're going to do about me?"
"Oh, you can be sure they will do something. And I get the feeling they're loading for bear. Consider yourself warned."
"And I'd advise you to be the sweet, ignorant angel who knows nothing and says nothing. Things could get messy."
"If they do, Marshall, can I come to you for answers? Or at least a ticket out of town?"
"We'll be able to deal."
"I'll give you anything I can find if you'll keep me safe."
Marshall caught it in her voice. This gal was scared.
"Hey, now, remember, I didn't ask you to get involved."
"I didn't ask to be involved. I just am. I know Alf Brummel. I'd better pick you for my friend."
"I'll keep you posted. Now hang up and act normal."
She did. Alf Brummel was in Julene Langstrat's office, and the two of them were looking over a very thick portfolio of information Brummel had brought.
"Hogan now has enough to fill a front page,"
Brummel said quite unhappily.
"You've berated me for being slow and taking care of Bush, but as far as I can see, you've given Hogan nothing but a clear freeway since the beginning."
"Calm down, Alf.
Langstrat said soothingly.
Just calm down.
He's going to be coming after me for an interview any day now, just like he's gone after all the others. What do you suggest I say to him?
Langstrat was a little shocked at his stupidity.
Don't say anything, of course.
Brummell paced the room, exasperated.
I don't have to, Jeline. By this point, nothing I say or don't say will make any difference anyway. He already has everything he needs. He knows about the property sales. He has very good leads and all the share of sales of the tax-delinquent homes. He knows about the corporation and the society. He has good information on the college embezzlements. He even has more than enough evidence to accuse me of false arrest.
Langstrat smiled with pleasure.
Your spy has done very well.
She brought me a lot of this material today. He's getting it all organized in a file now. He's about to make his move, I'd say.
Langstrat gathered all the material neatly, placed it back in its portfolio, and leaned back in her chair.
I love it.
Brummell only looked at her in amazement and shook his head.
You could lose at this game some day, you know. We could all lose.
I love a challenge, she exulted. I love taking on a strong opponent. The stronger the opponent, the more exhilarating the victory. Most of all, I love winning.
She smiled at him, truly pleased.
Alf, I've had my doubts about you, but I think you've come through bountifully. I think you should be there to see Mr. Hogan step into the snare.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Oh, you will. You will.
There was a short lull, and it got strangely quiet around the town of Ashton. People weren't in touch. Nothing much was said. During the day, Marshall and Bernice organized their materials and stuck close to the office. Marshall took Kate out to dinner one night. Bernice sat at home and tried to read a novel. Alf Brummell kept regular hours, but he didn't have much to say to Sarah or anyone else about anything. Langstrat fell ill, or so the word was from her office, and her classes were canceled for a few days. Hank and Mary thought that maybe their phone was out of order, the thing had been so silent. The Colemans visited relatives out of town. The Forsythes took the chance to do some inventory at the lumber yard. The rest of the remnant all went about their normal business. There was an odd stillness everywhere. The skies were hazy, the sun a blurred ball of light, the air warm and sticky. It was quiet. But no one could relax. High on a hill above the town, in the top of a graying, long-dead snag of an old tree, like an enormous black vulture, Rhaefar, the Prince of Babylon, sat. Other demons attended him, waiting to hear his next command, but Rhaefar was silent. Hour upon hour, a tense scowl on his face, he sat and gazed down at the town with his slowly shifting yellow eyes. On another hill, directly across the town from Rhaefar's big dead tree, Tal and his warriors concealed themselves in the woods. They also were looking out over the town, and they could feel the lull, the silence, the ominous deadness of the air. Gilo stood at his captain's side, and he knew this feeling. It had always been the same throughout the centuries. "It could be any time now. Are we ready?" he asked Tal. "No," Tal said flatly, looking intensely over the town. "Not all the remnant are gathered. Those who have gathered are not praying, not enough. We haven't the numbers or the strength. And the black cloud of spirits over the strong man grows 100-fold each day." Tal looked up into the sky over Ashton. "They will fill the sky from horizon to horizon." From their hiding place, they could look across the valley over several miles and see their hideous opponent sitting in the big dead tree. "His strength has not waned," said Gilo. "He is more than ready to do battle," said Tal. "And he can pick his own time, his own place, and the best of his warriors. He could attack on 100 different fronts at once." Gilo only shook his head. "You know we can't defend that many." Just then a messenger rushed toward them on the wing. "Captain," he said, alighting next to Tal, "I've brought word from the strongman's lair. There is a stirring there. The demons are growing restless." "It's beginning," said Tao, and this word was passed back through the ranks. "Gailo?" Gailo stepped up.
"Captain?"
Tao took Gailo aside. "I have a plan. I want you to take a small contingent with you and set up watch over that valley." Gailo was not one to argue with the captain, but...
"A small contingent? To watch the strong man?"
The two of them continued in conference, Tao mapping out his instructions, Gailo shaking his head dubiously. At length, Gailo came back to the group, picked out his warriors, and said, "Let's be off." With a rush of wings, the two dozen weaved and zigzagged through the forest until they were far enough away to take to the open sky. Tao summoned a strong warrior. "Replace Signa in guarding the church, and tell him to come to me." Then he summoned another messenger. "Tell Prione and Triskel to rouse Hank and get him praying, and all the remnant." In a short moment, Signa arrived. "Come with me," said Tao. "Let's talk." It had been a quiet afternoon for Hank and Mary. Mary spent most of it in the little garden behind the house, while Hank worked to repair a corner of the backyard fence that kids had broken a hole through. As Mary hunted for weeds among her vegetables, she noticed Hank's hammering getting more and more sporadic, until finally it stopped altogether. She looked his way and saw him sitting there, the hammer still in his hand, praying. He seemed very disturbed, so she asked,
"Are you all right?"
Hank opened his eyes, and without looking up, he shook his head.
"I don't feel good at all."
She went over to him.
"What is it?"
Hank knew where the feeling came from.
"The Lord, I guess. I just feel something's really wrong. Something terrible is about to happen. I'm going to call the Forsythes."
Just then the phone in the house rang. Hank went in and answered it. It was Andy Forsythe.
"Sorry to bother you, Pastor, but I was just wondering if you feel a real burden of prayer right now. I know I sure do."
"Come on over," said Hank.
The fence would have to wait. On into the evening, the angelic host waited, while Hank, the Forsythes, and several others prayed. Rafar continued to sit up in the dead tree, his eyes beginning to glow in the steadily thickening darkness. His taloned fingers continued to drum his knee. His brow stayed crinkled with his intense scowl. Behind him a host of demons began to gather, primed with anticipation and rapt with attention, waiting to hear Rafar's order. The sun dipped behind the hills on the west side. The sky was washed with red fire. Rafar sat and waited. The demonic host waited. In her bedroom, Jolene Langstrat sat on her bed, her legs crossed in the lotus position of Eastern meditation, her eyes closed, her head erect, her body perfectly still. Except for one single candle, the room was dark. There, under the shroud of the darkness, she convened her meeting with the ascended masters, the spirit guides from the higher planes. Deep within her consciousness, far within the depths of her inner being, she spoke with a messenger. To the eyes of Langstrat's entranced mind, the messenger appeared as a young lady, all dressed in white, with flowing blonde hair that reached nearly to the ground and was constantly in motion, wafted by the breeze.
"Where is my master?"
Langstrat asked the messenger.
"He waits above the town, watching over it," came the girl's answer. "His armies are ready for your word."
"All is ready. He may await my signal."
"Yes, my lady."
The messenger departed like a beautiful gazelle, leaping gracefully away. The messenger departed, a filthy black nightmare of a creature born on membranous wings. He departed to take word to Rafar, who still waited. Darkness deepened over Ashton. The candle in Langstrat's room dwindled to one round ebbing flame in a pool of wax, the inky blackness overtaking its weak orange light. Langstrat stirred, opened her glazed eyes, and arose from the bed. With a very small puff of breath, she extinguished the candle and moved in a half daze into the living room, where another candle was burning on the coffee table, the wax flowing and hardening into macabre fingers across the photograph of Ted Harmel on which the candle sat. Langstrat sank to her knees beside the coffee table. her head held high, her eyes half shut, her movements slow and liquid. As if floating in space, her arms rose upward over the candle, stretching out an invisible canopy over the flame. And then, so very quietly, the name of an ancient god began to form itself on her lips again and again. The name, a guttural harsh sound, spilled forth from her like the spitting of hundreds of invisible pebbles, and with each mention of the name her trance deepened. Steadily, steadily, the name tumbled forth, louder and faster, and Langstrat's eyes widened and remained unblinking and glaring. Her body began to quiver and tremble. Her voice became an eerie wailing sound. Rhaefar could hear it all from where he sat and waited. His own breathing began to deepen and chug out of his nostrils like putrid yellow steam. His eyes narrowed, his talons flexed. Langstrat swayed and quivered, calling out the name, calling out the name, her eyes fixed on the candle's flame, calling out the name. And then she froze. Rhaefar looked up, very still, very attentive, listening. Time stood still. Langstrat remained motionless, her arms extended over the candle. Rhaefar listened. Air began to slowly flow into Langstrat's mouth and nostrils. Her lungs began to fill, and then with one sudden cry from deep within, she brought her hands down like a trap, clapping them on the candle's wick, snuffing out the flame.
"Go!"
shouted Rhaefar, and hundreds of demons shot into the sky like a thunderous flock of bats, rushing along a straight and level trajectory northward.
"Look!"
said an angelic warrior, and Tal and his host all saw what looked like a black swarm silhouetted against the night sky, an elongated puff of smoke.
"Going north," observed Tal, "away from Ashton."
Rhaefar watched the squadron disappear at great speed and let a mocking grin bare his fangs.
"I'll keep you guessing, Captain of the Host!"
Tal shouted out his orders.
"Cover Hogan and Bush! Awaken the remnant!"
100 angels soared downward into the town. Tal could still see Rhaefar sitting in the big dead tree.
"Just what are your plans, Prince of Babylon?" he murmured.
The phone startled Marshall out of a restless sleep. The clock said 3:48 a.m. Kate moaned at being awakened. He grabbed up the receiver and mumbled hello. For a moment, he didn't have the slightest idea who was on the other end or what they were saying. The voice was wild, hysterical, high-pitched.
"Hey, simmer down and slow down, or I'll hang up," Marshall snapped hoarsely.
Suddenly, he recognized the voice.
"Ted? Is this Ted?"
"Hogan,"
came Ted Harmel's voice.
"They're coming for me. They're all over the place."
Marshall was awake now. He pressed the receiver to his ear, trying to understand what Ted was blubbering about.
"I can't hear you. What'd you say?"
"They found out I talked. They're all over the place."
"Who is?"
Ted started crying and screaming unintelligibly, and the sound of it was enough to make Marshall's insides curl up. He groped around the bedside stand for his pen and pad.
"Ted!"
he shouted into the phone, and Kate jerked with a start and turned over to look at him.
"Where are you? Are you home?"
Kate could hear the cries and wailing squawking out of the receiver, and it unnerved her.
"Marshall, who is it?" she demanded.
Marshall couldn't answer her. He was too occupied trying to get a clear answer from Ted Harmel.
"Ted, listen. Tell me where you are."
Pause. Some more cries.
"How do I get there?" "I said, how do I get there?"
Marshall began scribbling hurriedly.
"Try getting out of there if you can."
Kate listened, but couldn't make out what the party on the other end was saying. Marshall told whoever it was,
"Listen, it's going to take me at least half an hour to get there, and that's if I can find a station open to get some gas. No, I'll get over there. Just hang tight. All right? Ted? All right?"
"Who's Ted?"
"All right," said Marshall into the phone. "Give me time. I'll get out there. Just take it easy. Goodbye."
He hung up the phone and bolted out of bed.
"Who in the world was that?"
Kate needed to know. Marshall grabbed his clothes and began to dress hurriedly.
"Ted Harmel. Remember I told you about him?"
"You're not going over there tonight, are you?"
The guy's going crazy or something. I don't know. You get back in bed. Kate, I have to go. I can't afford to lose this contact.
No, I don't believe this. You can't be serious.
Marshall was serious. He kissed Kate goodbye before she could even bring herself to believe he was really going, and then he was gone. She sat there in the bed for a few moments, stunned, then flopped down angrily on her back, staring at the ceiling as she heard the car back down the driveway and speed off into the night. Chapter 24 Marshall drove about 30 miles north through the town of Windsor and a little beyond. He was surprised to find out how close to Ashton Ted Harmel still lived, especially after they both met in the mountains over 100 miles further up Highway 27. This guy has to be crazy, Marshall thought. And maybe I'm just as crazy to be going along with this whole routine. The guy's paranoid, a real space case. But he sure sounded convincing over the phone. Besides, it was a chance to reopen communications with him after that one-time-only interview. Marshall had to do some backtracking and groping around the maze of winding, unmarked back roads in his efforts to make sense of Harmel's directions. When he finally located the little shake-sided house at the end of a long gravel road, a ribbon of pink light was growing on the horizon. He'd taken an hour and a half to get there. Yes, there was the old Valiant parked in the driveway. Marshall pulled in behind it and got out of the car. The front door of the house was open. The front window was broken. Marshall crouched just a little behind his car, taking a moment to check out the situation. He didn't like the feelings he was getting at all. His insides had gone through this kind of dance before, that night when Sandy had run off, and again there seemed no obvious upfront reason for it. He hated to admit it, but he was afraid to take another step.
"Ted?" he called, not too loudly. There was no answer. It didn't look good at all.
Marshall forced himself to make his way around his car, up the walk, and onto the front porch very slowly, very carefully. He kept listening, looking, feeling. There was no sound except his own pounding heart. His shoes crunched just a little on the shards of broken glass from the window. The sound seemed deafening. "Come on, Hogan, get with it."
"Ted?" he called through the open door. "Ted Harmel? It's Marshall Hogan."
No answer. But this had to be Ted's place. There was his coat hanging on the rack. On the wall above the dining room table was a framed front page from the Clarion. He ventured inside. The place was a mess. The dishes that had been in the corner hutch were now shattered all over the floor. In the living room, a chair lay broken on the floor just below a large hole in the plaster wall. The bulbs were shattered out of the ceiling light fixture. Books from the shelves were thrown everywhere. The side window was also broken out. And Marshall could feel it, just as strongly as before. That fierce, gut-wrenching terror he had felt that other night. He tried to shake it off, tried to ignore it, but it was there. His palms were slick with sweat. He felt weak. He looked around for a weapon and grabbed a fireplace poker. "Keep your back to the wall, Hogan. Keep quiet. Look out for blind corners." It was dark in here. The shadows were very black. He tried to take his time, tried to let his eyes get used to the dark. He felt for a light switch somewhere, anywhere. Behind and above him, a black leathery wing quietly repositioned. Leering yellow eyes watched his every move. Here, there, over there, all over the room, in the corners of the ceiling, upon the furniture, clinging like insects to the walls, were the demons, some of them letting out little snickers, some of them drooling blood. Marshall made his way stealthily to the desk in the drawer, and using a handkerchief to prevent fingerprints, slid the drawers open. They had not been disturbed. Keeping the poker at the ready, he continued to move through the house. The bathroom was a mess. The mirror was shattered, the shards were in the sink and all over the floor. He moved down the hall, staying close to the wall. Hundreds of pairs of yellow eyes watched his every move. There was an occasional hacking from the throat of a demon, a short burst of vapor from its dripping mouth. In the bedroom, the most loathsome spirits of all awaited him. They watched the bedroom doorway from their positions on the ceiling, on the walls, in every corner, and their breathing sounded like the dragging of chains through gravel-filled mud. From where he stood, Marshall could see just the corner of the bed through the bedroom door. He approached cautiously, making frequent checks behind and even above him. When he reached the bedroom door, a single image like a photograph was instantly engraved on his mind. 1 second seemed like an eternity as his eyes darted from the blood-spattered bedspread to the bullet-blasted skull of Ted Harmel to the large revolver still dangling from Harmel's limp hand. Shrieks, thunder, fangs bared to bite. The demons exploded from the walls, corners, every nook of the room, and like arrows went for Marshall's heart. A blinding flash. Then another, then another. The whitest hot light traced brilliant fiery arcs, a searing edge that cut through the flock of evil spirits like a scythe. Parts of demons tumbled into nothingness. Other demons imploded and vanished in instantaneous billows of red smoke. Waves of spirits still poured down upon the one lone man who stood there in reasonless terror. But suddenly this man was surrounded by 4 heavenly warriors robed in glorious light, their crystalline wings unfurled like a canopy over their charge, their swords blurring into waving, swirling sheets of brilliance. The air was filled with the deafening cries of hideous spirits as blades met flanks, necks, torsos, and demon after demon was flung aside in pieces that instantly disintegrated and vanished like vapor. Nathan, Armoth, and 2 other angels, Center and Creed, darted, fainted, spun, batted away one spirit and sliced another, thrusting their blades in a myriad of directions. The lightning from their swords flashed against the walls, bright enough to bleach out all colors. Nathan gutted one demon and sent it spiraling through the roof, leaving a red trail of vapor until it vanished. With his sword he slashed. With his free hand he collected demons by their heels. Armoth and Center whirled in a high-powered blur, mowing through demons as through grass. Cree threw himself against Marshall and kept his wings spread to protect the stunned man. "Push them back!" shouted Nathan, and he began to spin his fistful of demons about his head, feeling the shock of their bodies striking other demons with the rhythm of a stick on a picket fence. The demons began to shy back. Half their numbers were now gone, as was half their zeal. Nathan, Armoth, and Center started flying a tight spiral around Marshall, their swords knifing through the fading demonic ranks. One demon shot straight into the sky with a wail of terror. Center got right after it and quickly dispatched it like a slaughtered game bird. He remained above the house for a time, containing any fleeing spirits very neatly and abruptly, swatting them out of existence as if they were fast-served tennis balls. And then, almost as suddenly as it had begun, it was over. No demon remained. None had escaped. Nathan alighted back in the hallway as his wings folded and the light around him faded. "How's our man?" Cree was relieved to say. "He's still very shaken, but he's all right. He still has the will to fight." Armoth came in for a landing and immediately checked Ted Harmel's pitiful frame. Center dropped through the ceiling and joined him. Armoth shook his head and sighed. "As Captain Tal said, Rhaefar can choose any front he wants at any time." "They have owned and tormented Ted Harmel for a long time," Center conceded. "Is Kevin Weed covered?" Nathan asked. Armoth answered with a little curiosity. "Tal sent Signa to watch Care Weed." "Signa? Was he not assigned to guard the church?" "Tal must have a change in plans." Nathan got back to the immediate business. "We'd best see to Marshal Hogan." Marshall got a grip on himself. For a moment he thought he would really panic, and that would have been the very first time in his life. "Nuts, I don't need to get involved in this stuff. Not now," he thought. He took a few more moments to ease up and think the thing through. Harmel was history. But what about the others? He went into the dining room and found the phone. Using his handkerchief again and a pen to dial, he called the operator, who put him through to the police department in Windsor, a town closer than Ashton, fortunately. Something told Marshall that Brummel and his cops were definitely not the ones to call on this. "This is an anonymous call," he said. "There's been a fatal shooting, a suicide." He told the sergeant who answered how to get there and then hung up. Then he got out of there. Several miles further north, he pulled the Buick into a filling station and went into a phone booth. He first called Eldon Strawn's number. There was no answer. He had the operator ring the clarion.
Bernice should be there by now. Come on, girl, answer the phone.
Ashton Clarion?
It was Carmen. Carmen, this is Marshall. Put Bernice on, will you?
Sure thing.
Bernice picked up her extension immediately.
Hogan, are you calling in sick?
Act normal, Bernie, Marshall said. I've got some heavy developments.
Well, take an aspirin or something.
Good girl. Brace yourself for this one. I just came from Ted Harmel's place. He just blew his brains out. I got a call from him early this morning, and he was talking crazy, talking about somebody coming after him, so I drove to his place and just now found him. It looked like he'd had an all-out fight with something. The place was a mess.
So how are you feeling, really?
Bernice said, and Marshall could tell this was the acting job of her career. I'm shook up, but all right. I called the Windsor police, but chose to get out of there. Right now, I'm up near Windsor on Highway 38. I'm going to head north and drop by Strawn's place to check up on him. I want you to check on Weed right away. I don't want any more sources dying on me.
Do you think it's catching?
I don't know yet. Harmel was a little crazy. It may be an isolated incident. I do know I've got to talk to Strawn about it, and I don't want you to wait to check on Weed.
Okay, I'll do that today.
I should be back this afternoon. Be careful.
You take care of yourself.
Marshall got back in his car and checked his map for the best way to get to Eldon Strawn's place. It took him another hour to make the drive, but soon he was pulling up the same old driveway to the quaint little farmhouse. He slammed on the brakes, and the Buick lurched to a halt, skidding on the gravel. He opened the car door and had another look from outside his car windows. There was no mistake. The windows were broken in this house, too. Come to think of it, by now that collie would be barking. But the place was dead silent. Marshall left the car where it was and quietly made his way toward the house. No sounds. The windows on the side of the house were also broken. He noted that the glass was broken inward this time, unlike the Harmel house where the glass was broken out. He passed along the side of the house and checked the parking area in the back. No cars. He began praying that Eldon and Doris were gone and nowhere near whatever was happening. He went around the other side of the house, completely encircling it, then stepped onto the front porch and tried the front door. It was locked. He looked through the front window. The glass was mostly gone, and saw total chaos inside. The house had been ransacked. He carefully stepped through the window into the once quaint living room, now a pitiful shambles. The furniture was thrown everywhere. The cushions on the sofa were slashed open. The coffee table had been chopped in several pieces. Some floor lamps had been thrown down and broken. Everything was out of its place and thrown about.
Eldon? Marshall called. Doris? Anybody home?
As if I really expected an answer, he thought. But what was that on the mirror over the fireplace? He went for a closer look. Someone had taken red paint. Or was it blood? Marshall checked closely. With great relief, he smelled the unmistakable scent of paint. But someone had scrawled an obscene message of hate on the mirror, a very clear threat. He knew he would have to check every room in the house, and right at this moment he wondered why he didn't feel the same terror he had felt at Harmel's. Maybe this day was turning him numb. Maybe he just wasn't believing any of it anymore. He checked the whole house, upstairs and downstairs, and even the cellar. But there were no terrible discoveries, and he was very glad. That didn't make him any less concerned, nervous, or perplexed, however. This was too much of a coincidence, despite the basic differences. As he took a second look around the living room, he tried to think if there could be a connection. Obviously, both Harmel and Strawn had been sources for Marshall's investigation, and could have become targets for intimidation. But Harmel, in his terrible fear, could have done the damage around his house by himself, fighting off whatever it was, while this damage to Strawn's house was clearly the act of vandals, of malicious characters out to scare him. That was one connection, fear. Both Harmel and Strawn were the brunt of fear tactics, whatever form they took. But why would...
All right, freeze! Police!
Marshall stayed still, but he did look out through the broken window. There on the porch was a sheriff's officer aiming a gun at him.
Take it easy,
Marshall said very gently without moving. Get both hands in the air, in plain sight, the officer commanded. Marshall obeyed.
The name's Marshall Hogan, editor of the Ashton Clarion. I'm a friend of the Strawns. Just hold steady. I'll have to see some ID, Mr. Hogan.
Marshall explained everything he did as he did it.
I'm going to reach into my back pocket here, see? Here's my wallet. Now I'm going to toss it to you through the window there.
By now, the officer's partner had mounted the porch and also had his gun trained on Marshall. Marshall tossed his wallet through the broken window, and the first policeman picked it up. The officer checked Marshall's ID.
What are you doing here, Mr. Hogan? Trying to figure out what in blazes happened to Eldon's house. And I'd also like to know what happened to Eldon and Doris, his wife.
The officer seemed satisfied with Marshall's ID and relaxed just a little, but his partner kept a gun trained on Marshall. The officer tried the front door and then asked,
How'd you get in there? Through that window,
Marshall answered.
Okay, Mr. Hogan, I'm going to ask you to step very carefully back through the window and do it very slowly. Please keep both hands in plain sight.
Marshall obeyed. As soon as he got out on the porch, the officer turned him around, his hands against the wall, and frisked him. Marshall asked,
You guys from Windsor?
Windsor Precinct, came the short answer, and with that, the officer grabbed Marshall's wrists one at a time and slapped handcuffs on him.
We're placing you under arrest. You have the right to remain silent.
Marshall could think of all kinds of questions to ask, and it was all he could do to keep from disassembling these two. But he knew better than to say a word. Chapter 25 Bernice called Kevin Weed right after she got off the phone with Marshall, but there was no answer. He was probably working with the logging crew today. She dug through her file and found the phone number for Gorst Brothers Timber. They told her Kevin had not been in today, and if she saw him, she'd better tell him to show up quick or he'd be out of a job.
Thanks, Mr. Gorst.
She dialed the Evergreen Tavern in Baker. Dan, the proprietor, answered.
Sure, he said. Weed was in here this morning, just like he always is. He was in a gosh-awful mood, though. He got in a fight with one of his buddies. I had to throw them both out.
Bernice left Dan the Clarion's number in case he saw Weed again. Then she hung up and thought for a moment. It wasn't out of the question to drive out to Baker, and besides, orders were orders. She went over her schedule for the day and tried to rearrange her jobs to accommodate the trip. Carmen, she said, grabbing her jacket and handbag, I'll be gone for the day, I think. If Marshall calls, tell him I've gone out to check on a source. He'll know what I mean. Right-o, said Carmen. Baker was about 17 miles north on Highway 27. The apartments where Weed lived were about 2 miles closer. Bernice found them without too much trouble. A sad complex of dry, rotting cubicles honeycombed into a sun-bleached old warehouse. Bernice's nose told her the septic system was failing. She went up the plank stairs onto the loading dock, which now served as a patio and entranceway. Inside, she was appalled at how dark the building was. She looked down one long corridor and noted many closely spaced doors. These weren't apartments, they were lockers. She had heard some footsteps on the old planks upstairs, and now they came down the stairway just behind her. She turned her head just enough to see an unpleasant-looking character stepping down, a skinny, pimple-faced apparition in black leather. She immediately decided she had a very pressing appointment at the other end of the hall and started in that direction.
"Hi there," the man called to her. "Looking for someone?"
"Make it quick, Bernice.
Just visiting a friend, thank you."
"Have a nice visit," he said, and he kept looking her over as if she were a steak. She walked quickly down the corridor, hoping it wouldn't be a dead end, and though she didn't look back, she could tell he was still watching her. "Hogan, I'll get you for this." She was glad to find another stairway leading upstairs. Weed's apartment had a 200 number, so up the stairs she went. The stairwell was old, weathered planks illumined with one bare light bulb hanging from a very high rafter. Some 30 years ago, someone had tried to paint the walls. She wound her way upward, ignoring the disgusting graffiti everywhere, her shoes making hollow thuds on the worn planks. She reached the upstairs corridor and doubled back, following the descending numbers on the doors.
From behind some of the doors came sounds of soap operas, FM rock stations, marital spats. She finally found Weed's door and knocked. There was no answer. But her knocking nudged the door, and it drifted slowly open. She helped it quietly on its way. The place was an absolute mess. Bernice had seen the homes of many people before, but how could Weed possibly live in a disaster area like this? "Kevin?" she called. No answer. She stepped inside and closed the door. It had to be vandalism. Weed didn't own that much, but what he did own was thrown about, broken, spilled, and shattered. Papers and bric-a-brac were everywhere. The little cot in the corner was overturned. Weed's guitar was face down on the floor. The back stomped through. The bulbs were broken out of the ceiling fixture. The few second-hand dishes were in shattered pieces all over the floor in the little kitchen cubicle. Then she saw words spray-painted across one whole wall, an incredibly obscene threat. For the longest time, she didn't move. She was afraid. The implications were clear enough. How long would it be before they struck her or Marshall? She wondered what Marshall would find at Strawn's. She wondered what her own home looked like. And she realized there were no police to call. The police were with them. Finally, she slipped quietly out the door, wrote Weed a quick note in case he ever came back, and shoved it in the crack just above the doorknob. She looked this way and that, and then went along the corridor and back down the stairs again. Just one flight below the second floor, a wall formed a blind corner between the two flights at the middle landing. Bernice was just thinking how she didn't like blind corners in a place like this, and how the lighting was so poor. A black figure leaped at her from the flight below. Her body slammed into the old shiplap wall as her teeth clapped together. The man in leather, a rough, dirty hand grabbing a fistful of blouse, a violent sideways jerk, tearing cloth, her body reeling, an impact like an explosion in her left ear, a blurred, hate-filled face. She was falling. Her arms went out against the rough plank corner. They were limp. They buckled. She slid down the wall to the floor. A black boot blotted out her vision. Her glasses were driven into her face. Her skull thudded against the wall. She went numb. Her body kept jerking about. He was still hitting her. Step, 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 step. He was gone. She was dreaming. Her head was reeling. There was blood upon the floor and broken glasses and bent pieces. She slumped against the wall, still feeling the fist in her ear and the boot in her face, and hearing blood dripping from her mouth and her nose. The floor drew her down like a magnet until her head finally thumped on the boards. She whimpered, a gurgling sound as blood and saliva bubbled over her tongue. She spit it all out, raised her head, and cried out in a sound that was half cry, half moan. From somewhere up above, the boards began to pound and clatter with a sudden flow of traffic. She heard people shouting, swearing, thundering down the steps. She couldn't move. She kept half-dreaming as light and sound faded in and out. We're there. We're not there. Hands began to hold her, move her, cradle her. A cloth wiped across her mouth. She felt the new warmth of a blanket. A towel kept dabbing her face. She gurgled again, spit again. She heard someone swear again. Marshall still wouldn't reply to any questions, although the detective at the Windsor precinct kept trying. "We're talking about murder here, bub," the detective said. "Now we have it from reliable sources that you were there at Harmel's place early this morning. That's right near the time of death. Do you have anything to say about that?" "This flunky was born yesterday," Marshall thought. "Sure, punk, I'll tell you all about it so you can hang me." In a pig's eye, it was murder. But what really bothered Marshall was just who this reliable source was, and how that reliable source not only knew he'd been at Harmel's, but also knew these cops could find him at Strawn's. He was still working on the answer to that riddle. The detective asked, "So you're still not going to say anything?" Marshall wouldn't even nod or shake his head. "Well," the detective said with a half-shrug, "at least give me the name of your lawyer. You're going to need counsel." Marshall had no name to give him and couldn't even think of one. It became a waiting game. "Spence," said a deputy, "you got a call from Ashton." The detective picked up the phone at his desk. "Nelson." "Oh, hi there, Alf. What's up?"
"Alf Brimmel."
Yeah, the detective said. He's right here. You want to talk to him? He sure won't talk to us.
He offered Marshall a receiver.
Al from L.
Marshall took the receiver.
Yeah, this is Hogan.
Alf Brummel was acting shocked and dismayed.
Marshall, what's going on up there?
I can't say.
They tell me Ted Harmel was murdered and that they have you as a suspect. Is that true?
I can't say.
Alf was beginning to catch on.
Marshall, listen, I'm calling to see if I can help. Now, I'm sure there's been a mistake, and I'm sure we can work something out. What were you doing up at Harmel's place anyway?
I can't say.
That flustered him.
Marshall, for crying out loud, will you just forget that I'm a cop? I'm also your friend. I want to help you.
Do it.
I want to. I really want to. Now listen, let me talk to Detective Nelson again. Maybe we can work something out.
Marshall handed the receiver back to Nelson. Nelson and Brummel talked for a while, and it sounded like they knew each other pretty well.
Well, you might be able to do more with him than I ever will, said Nelson quite pleasantly.
Sure, why not?
Huh? Yeah, okay.
Nelson looked at Marshall.
He's on another line. Guess he'll vouch for you, and I think he can take jurisdiction over your case, if there is one.
Marshall nodded all too knowingly. Now Brummel would have Marshall right where he wanted him, if there was a case. If there wasn't one, Brummel would find one. What would it be now, Harmel and Hogan running a child-molesting ring with a gangland-type murder? Nelson heard Brummel come back on the line.
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, sure.
Nelson handed Marshall the receiver again. Brummel was upset, or at least he sounded like it.
Marshall, that was the fire district that just called. They've just sent an aid car out toward Baker. It's Bernice. She's been assaulted.
Marshall never thought he'd hope Brummel was lying.
Tell me more.
We won't know more till they get out there. It won't take long. Listen, they're going to release you on personal recognizance under my supervision. You'd better get back to Ashton right away. Can you see me in my office at, say, 3?
Marshall thought he would have a seizure trying to contain all the cuss words he had for this whole thing.
I'll be there, Alf. Nothing could keep me away.
Good. I'll see you then.
Marshall returned the receiver to Nelson. Nelson smiled and said,
We'll take you back to your car.
The man in black leather was back in Ashton, running down the streets and then through the alleys like a man possessed, looking behind him, panting, crying, terrified. 5 cruel spirits rode on his back, ducked in and out of his body, clung to him like huge leeches, their talons deeply embedded in his flesh. But they were not in control. They, too, were terrified. Just above the 5 demons and their running victim, 6 angelic warriors floated along with their swords drawn, moving this way and that, to the right, to the left, whatever it took to keep the demons herded in the right direction. The demons hissed and spat and made shooing motions with their sinewy hands. The young man ran, swatting at invisible bees. The young man and his demons came to a corner. They tried to go left. The angels blocked their way and prodded them with their swords to the right. With a cry and a terrible wailing, the demons fled to the right. The demons began to cry for mercy.
No, let us alone, they pleaded. You have no right.
Just up the street, Hank Bush and Andy Forsythe were walking together, taking some time to share their burdens and pray. Right alongside them walked Triskal, Crayoni, Seth, and Sion. The 4 warriors all saw what their comrades were herding their way, and they were more than ready.
"Time for an object lesson for the man of God," said Crayoni.
Triskal only beckoned to the demons with his finger and said,
"Come, come."
Andy looked down the street and saw the man first.
"Well,
what?" asked Hank, seeing the dumbfounded look on Andy's face.
"Get ready. Here comes Bobby Corsi."
Hank looked and cringed at the sight of a wild-looking character running toward them, his eyes filled with terror, his arms beating the air as he battled unseen enemies. Andy cautioned,
"Be careful. He could be violent."
"Oh, terrific." They stood still and waited to see what Bobby would do. Bobby saw them and cried out in even more terror,
"No, no, leave us alone."
Heaven's warriors were bad enough, but the five demons wanted no part of Bush and Forsyth. They twisted Bobby around and tried to run away, but were instantly hemmed in by the Angelic Six. Bobby stopped dead in his tracks. He looked at nothing ahead of him, then at Hank and Andy, and then looked again at his unseen enemies. He screamed, standing still where he was, his hands claw-like and trembling, his eyes bulging and glazed. Hank and Andy moved forward very slowly.
"Easy, Bobby," Andy said soothingly. "Take it easy now."
"No!" Bobby screamed. "Leave us alone! We want no business with you!"
An angel gave one of the demons a prod with the tip of his sword.
"Oh!"
Bobby cried out in pain, collapsing to his knees.
"Leave us alone! Leave us alone!"
Hank stepped forward quickly and said firmly, "In Jesus' name, be quiet!" Bobby let out one more scream. "Be quiet!" Bobby grew still and began to weep, kneeling there on the sidewalk. "Bobby," said Hank, bending down and speaking gently. "Bobby, can you hear me?" A demon clapped his hands over Bobby's ears. Bobby did not hear Hank's question. Hank, hearing from the Spirit of God, knew what the demon was doing. "Demon, in the name of Jesus, let go of his ears." The demon jerked his hands away, a surprised look on his face. Hank asked again, "Bobby?" This time Bobby answered,
"Yeah, preacher, I hear you."
"Do you want to be free from these spirits?" Immediately one demon answered,
"No, you don't. He belongs to us."
And Bobby spit the words in Hank's face.
"No, you don't. He belongs to us."
"Spirit, be quiet. I'm talking to Bobby." The demon said no more, but backed off sulkingly. Bobby muttered,
"I've just done a horrible thing."
He began to weep.
"You gotta help me. I can't stop from doing this stuff."
Hank spoke quietly aside to Andy. "Let's get him somewhere where we can deal with him, where he can make a scene if he has to. The church? Come on, Bobby." They took him by his arms and helped him up, and the three and the five and the six and the four headed up the street. Marshall sped through Baker and then made a quick swing by the apartment complex where Weed lived. There seemed to be no activity there, so he drove on into Ashton. When he reached the hospital, the aid car was parked outside. An emergency medical technician who was securing the stretcher back in the vehicle filled Marshall in. "She's in the emergency room, two doors down." Marshall burst through the main doors and got to the right room in an instant. He heard a cry of pain from Bernice just as he reached the door. She was lying on a table, attended by a doctor and two nurses who were washing her face and dressing her cuts. At the sight of her, Marshall could contain himself no longer. All the anger and frustration and terror of this whole day exploded from his lungs in one vehement expletive. Bernice responded through swollen and bleeding lips,
"I guess that about covers it."
He hurried to the side of the table as the doctor and two nurses gave him room. He took her hand in both of his and couldn't believe what had happened to her. Her attacker had been merciless.
"Who did this to you?" he demanded, his blood boiling.
"We went the whole 15 rounds, boss."
"Don't clown with me, Bernie. Did you see who did it?"
The doctor cautioned him.
"Easy now. Let's take care of her first."
Bernice whispered something. Marshall couldn't make it out. He leaned closer and she whispered it again, her swollen mouth slurring her words.
"He didn't rape me."
"Thank God," Marshall said, straightening up.
She wasn't satisfied with his response. She motioned to him again to lean forward and listen.
"All he did was beat me up. That's all he did."
"Aren't you satisfied?"
Marshall whispered back rather loudly. She was handed a glass of water to wash her mouth out. She swirled the water around in her mouth and spit into a bowl.
"Was Strawn's house nice and neat?"
she asked. Marshall held back his answer. He asked the doctor,
"When can I talk to her in private?"
The doctor thought about it.
"Well, she's going in for x-rays in just a few minutes."
"Give me 30 seconds, Bernice requested. "Just 30 seconds.
"It can't wait?"
No, please.
The doctor and the nurses stepped out of the room. Marshall spoke softly.
Strawn's place was a mess. Somebody really went through it. He's gone. I have no idea where he is or how he is.